Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
I think that for Catholics, the election of Kennedy was an important moment in history where they were recognized and accepted by American society as true Americans.
Fundamentalism and liberalism do agree on this point, that your basic identity is what you do.
Why is it that my grandparents in the 1940s, why didn't they demand that their churches offer Glenn Miller big band style church?
Because you're not preaching the law, you're still leaving them dead in their sins and they don't know what the gospel is about. You're basically pronouncing absolution without confession.
On-demand listeners of Issues Etc. love hearing sound theology while walking the dog.
That term media bias has, well, it's so general, so easily applied to any situation as to be almost useless. Maybe the best definition for what we see, especially in religion coverage in the popular media, is best explained in terms of its particulars, where we actually find it, what we actually see going on. The old media orthodoxy, journalistic orthodoxy, was there is no orthodoxy. Is there a new one at work, and what does it mean for both religion coverage and for journalism in general? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Tuesday afternoon. It's the 26th of November. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly will join us here for the first half hour of the program. We're going to talk about media coverage of the trial of a United Methodist pastor who performed his son's same-sex wedding ceremony and how it's being covered, in particular by the Washington Post. A little bit later, we'll talk about reformational Catholicism, an interesting term. We'll find out what it means. Peter Lighthart has written a recent column for First Things magazine titled The End of Protestantism. And then Pastor Ted Giese joins us. We're going to review the new movie, Hunger Games, Catching Fire. He's a regular contributor to the Canadian Lutheran magazine. And then also Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will continue our series in the last half hour of this Tuesday afternoon's Issues Etc. Christ in the Old Testament will be in Isaiah, the opening chapters, The Mountain of the Lord. Terry Mattingly is a regular guest. He's director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, and he's founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Very glad to be here.
The story comes out of the United Methodist Church. There's a pastor who performed his son's same-sex wedding ceremony. He's been called on the carpet officially to deal with the disparity between his actions and the official position of the United Methodist Church. You say there's a kind of journalistic orthodoxy when it comes to stories like this emerging from the United Methodist Church. What is it?
Well, you would think that there was. I mean, if you asked most Americans the attitude of the mainstream press toward religion, they'd have a very quick answer for you in the sense that they would call it the secular press, which would mean that the attitude would be primarily secular, which in the old days, people usually thought that that meant that the press tended to have a kind of a closed attitude toward religious truth claims at all, and that that was the worst thing you could say about the media was that it was some sort of aggressive secularism. Through the last couple of decades, I've increasingly begun to wonder if that was really what was going on here, and whether or not we weren't into something more subtle. I mean, a secularism, a kind of a modern or a viewpoint represented by representative of modernity, that approach would say, you get to make your truth claim, I get to make my truth claim, and the press needs to be inherently secular and hands-off in judging the truth of those respective religious claims, which means the reader then gets to make up their mind. And isn't that what you're used to hearing is kind of the normal journalism attitude?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so, and there are Christian critics, the historian Marvin Olasky of World Magazine among them, who notes that this is a kind of a hostile viewpoint in itself, that There's kind of like an enforced secularism here that says there is no absolute truth, and the press kind of stands in between and gets to balance one thing off another. Well, that's what I grew up thinking of the press in terms of religion. But I'm beginning to wonder, and this story is the latest one to really make me think this way, I'm beginning to wonder if there isn't an actual change going on in the press, and that the press is now beginning to violate its own standards in this area. But first of all, let me share with you the name of an essay readers might want to look up, and if so, you know, you could put this up on the website. And it's by a professor named Jay Rosen, and it's called Religion is Itself, Journalism is Itself a Religion. Journalism is Itself a Religion. There you go. Now, what he was arguing is that this was the old religion of journalism, the religion that there is no religion, what he calls the orthodoxy of no orthodoxy. And he said that's always been kind of a philosophical conundrum. It's a maze. However, in recent years, it's pretty apparent to me that on some stories, the press has decided that there is a religious truth involved in some of these stories. And in effect, the secular press can no longer be called secular. If it ever could be called secular, that's no longer the case. And this Methodist story is a perfect example. If you read primarily the Washington Post coverage of this, the Post quotes advocates of a theological perspective calling for equality for gays and lesbians. They quote experts on that point of view over and over and over, and the entire story is framed through their viewpoint, whereas in the coverage I have seen so far, there has only been one paragraph coming from an authoritative voice defending the United Methodist Church's own teachings. And I know this might be hard for listeners to follow, but in other words, the Washington Post is advocating a theological perspective as true, which violates the old media standard of the orthodoxy of no orthodoxy. Does that make sense? Was that too complicated?
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. They've decided they are going to take sides. In simple terms, they decided they are going to take sides in an essentially theological religious debate.
Yeah, you can't even say, as we have, I've often said in the past, that the media has a bias against people who argue from a position of religious certainty, you know, that certain things are in fact true. It seems now in the Washington Post coverage of the Schaefer trial that they have decided that something is true and that the newspaper needs to advocate a theological perspective as accurate over the claims of another. And at that point, you're no longer really talking about the secular press. You're talking about a religious press that has a theological axe to grind instead of one that's presenting a kind of a modern scientific approach of we're going to let you hear one side's perspective, then we're going to let you hear the other side's perspective, and you make up your own mind. You decide what the truth is between the two. Years ago, I wrote a column that kind of hinted at the direction this was going and quoted a man named William Proctor. And Proctor was talking about the religious perspectives of the New York Times. And I'm going to quote a little bit of Proctor's statement at the time I interviewed him. He said, there's irony in all this. The agenda of the Times advocates is based on a set of absolute truths. Its leaders are, quote, absolutely sure that the religious groups they consider intolerant and judgmental are absolutely wrong, especially traditional Roman Catholics, evangelicals, and most Orthodox Jews. And they are just as convinced that the religious groups they consider tolerant and progressive are absolutely right at the same time. So, in other words, the question that we see raised often in the New York Times and in the Washington Post coverage of this particular trial up in Pennsylvania is whether or not the Washington Post is still a secular newspaper.
How does this square, Terry, with something that you have observed many times here, and that is that the religion of journalism is, in essence, politics. How would you reconcile the two assertions here?
Well, it could be that the political claims of people on one side of the abortion issue are the political claims of people on one side of the gay rights issue have, in effect, driven this judgment of what is theologically correct. But when you see it in a story such as the Schaefer trial story, politics is being mentioned, but they're also making very theological claims, the voices of the people that they're quoting time and time again, so that in the end, the story is even framed remarkably as religion instead of politics, and it's very clear which theological perspective the Washington Post considers to be the true one, as opposed to doing a genuinely secular approach to the issue, which would be to, say, have five quotes from people defending the United Methodist position, and then, say, five or six quotes from people criticizing it, and the reader gets to read both perspectives in some sort of balance and then make up their own mind. So, once again, I know this sounds radical, but what I'm actually arguing in these posts that get religion, I'm arguing that the Washington Post has, in effect, become a theological voice in those stories.
So, are they unique in this, or is this something that you find elsewhere?
I've seen it elsewhere, particularly on these kind of post-Woodstock cultural and moral issues. The sexual revolution may be the actual dividing line here more than it is a particular articulated theological or political perspective. This is also true. You'll remember the Pew Forum study of the religiously unaffiliated, or the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S crowd that's gotten so much ink. The Pew Forum found that the primary dividing line between people with no religious affiliation and those who are religiously active, the easiest way to spot the bright red line between those two groups is their positions on sexual morality. That ends up being family, marriage, and sex are the dividing line issues between these two groups. Thus, what the Washington Post in this story seems to be advocating is the theological perspective of religious groups, especially liberal mainline Protestants, people within the United Methodist Church who want to change the church's doctrines, for example. That's the theological perspective of the people who get along better with the sexual and moral viewpoint of the nuns, the religiously unaffiliated, and perhaps the majority of people in an elite newsroom.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. He's founder and editor of GetReligion.org. When we come back 10 more minutes with him, talking about media coverage of the trial of a United Methodist pastor who performed his son's same-sex wedding ceremony.
Thankful for God's service through the pastors in your life? Then consider attending Christ for Us in the Office of the Holy Ministry, a conference of the Association of Confessing Evangelical Lutheran Congregations, this coming February 25th through 27th in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Visit our website at acelc.net for information on Christ for Us in the Office of the Ministry. Register online at acelc.net.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
South Africa.
China.
Germany.
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues, Etc. around the world? India.
Sweden.
Egypt. France.
Turkey. Japan.
Australia. Canada.
United Kingdom.
Hong Kong. Austria.
Finland. Malaysia.
Singapore. Bulgaria.
Korea.
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines.
Mexico.
Spain.
New Zealand.
Kuwait.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin on this Tuesday afternoon, November the 26th. Terry Mattingly is our guest, founder and editor of GetReligion.org. We're talking about media coverage of the trial of a United Methodist pastor who performed his son's same-sex wedding ceremony. Terry, the Washington Post cover story on this, of the Schaefer trial, was this presented as the official position of the United Methodist Church? Was it the traditional biblical view of historic Christianity? Or was it, as I think you say in the article, just some church rules?
Well, yeah. The language throughout the stories, for the most part, is that this man just didn't like the United Methodist Church's rules and its book of discipline. What wasn't addressed in the story was that in order to be ordained, this man would have taken vows, ordination vows, in which he pledged to defend not only Holy Scripture as understood by the United Methodist Church, but to defend the book of discipline and the rules therein. So in other words, you had a theological vow to help defend these planks that hold the United Methodist Church up. Now, the story also makes what I think is a perfectly valid point, that for decades it's been apparent that United Methodists do not agree on the existence of a lot of these rules, and they don't agree on one common approach to Scripture, biblical authority, etc. At that point, you could say that the man took those vows, and in a postmodern sense, the vows meant whatever he wanted them to mean. But I still thought the story should have admitted that what he was actually on trial for was not performing the marriage rite of his son to another man. That was the act that brought the trial up. What he was on trial for was violating his own ordination vows. And so when you finally got a voice of authority defending the United Methodist Church's teachings, I thought it was significant that that United Methodist leader immediately said what we were dealing with here is the breach of a covenant. And he used the word covenant. And the minute you say that word in a theological context, what are you talking about? You're talking about a theological vow, an agreement that has two sides. So in other words, there was a covenant between this man, this pastor, and his church, and he was on trial for violating that covenant.
Not that Pastor Schaefer was either at liberty or necessarily willing to talk to the press. I'm not sure about that. But would a question have been in order, such as, what did you think you were promising to do when you were ordained?
Yep. Yeah, he did talk on a limited basis to the Washington Post and to the press, and the majority of people at the trial were activists coming at this from the theological and cultural left. But he was, needless to say, not asked that question. In fact, the issue of ordination vows are mentioned nowhere in the Washington Post coverage other than this reference to a covenant in the one paragraph that is quoted from a conservative United Methodist authority figure. The Post story, I should mention, does a great job of quoting on both people on both sides of the issue at the level of the split within Schaefer's own church. So the people who were testifying that he divided their church and the people who were testifying that they were in favor of the changes, the local people were quite well represented between the two sides. It was when you got to this whole thing of what is this really all about? What makes this trial a national page one story in the Washington Post? All that national framing, all of the larger issues were all painted completely from the viewpoint of the theological left.
Okay, so it was a national story. I'm trying to think from the Washington Post perspective. It was a national story because It is the little guy beleaguered by the institution. He's just trying to be a good Methodist. He's got 50% of his denomination on his side, and the big meanies from the headquarters or whatever are putting him on trial for participating in the same-sex marriage of his son, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, in other words, and surely that is the most poignant aspect of the story, that this is a ritual, an illegal from the perspective of the United Methodist Church, this is a ritual for his own son, that in effect, the United Methodist Church is saying, you must turn down this request from your own son in order to keep your vows. Now, one of the things I was curious about was, I am sure that, A, this is not the first time this has happened, and I am also sure that there are United Methodist clergy who have chosen to refuse similar requests from their children in the past. That would be an interesting question. For all I know, there might be United Methodist pastors who have declined to perform the wedding ceremonies of their children who are in mixed-gender weddings, but they say have been cohabitating with their fiancé for years before. There might be pastors who have had to refuse that request in order to defend the doctrines of the church. I don't know. What I'm saying is that this is a very complex issue, but it's never stated in the Washington Post coverage that the critical, pivotal issue is this man's own vows to the church.
The other angle here that I wanted you to address, and it's something that you've actually been following for several decades, is that angle of the kind of disunity in the United Methodist Church at the grassroots level over these kinds of issues, and as you say, the potential for schism. What are your thoughts there, Terry?
Well, first of all, it's not just the United Methodist. The entire mainline Protestant world is fighting over this, and you actually do have, you know, at court cases and schisms at every conceivable level, in the Episcopal Church in particular, in the Presbyterian Church USA. You have, it's been years since conservatives lost this battle in the United Church of Christ, but you still have conservatives continuing to drift away from that liberal church year after year. So in one sense, it's all of the whole world of mainline Protestantism that's torn up over this. Behind the scenes, you could argue that you have similar fights going on among some Catholics, etc. But the mainline Protestant world is who is most engaged in warfare over this. In that sense, the United Methodist Church is extremely important in that it's the largest mainline Protestant church still standing. And because of its structure, when it gets together to vote on these issues, they have quite a few voices represented in the voting coming from Third World and Global South churches, which tend to be, A, growing, not shrinking, like the American church, growing and quite doctrinally conservative. So much as we've seen in the Anglican fights as a battle between Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the frozen chosen in Europe and America, the same thing happens in United Methodism, in that you have people of color from other parts of the world voting for small-o orthodoxy on these issues, colliding with the more authoritative figures, you know, in the North American church. So this is a very typical mainline Protestant war. The United Methodists, though, have so far not buckled, which is why the left now, which controls, I think most people would agree, they control most of the kind of hierarchy and elite establishment of United Methodism in terms of seminaries, boards, and agencies. They keep losing the fight, however, at the level of their conventions. So you're now beginning to hear the left talk openly about schism, I guess because they're losing.
With only a minute here, Terry, if what you have observed is true, and the old orthodoxy of no orthodoxy has been replaced with kind of a new journalistic orthodoxy that you've described here, how do you think that bodes for the future of religion coverage?
Wow, great question. I think, if anything, it means that we're going to have the public will become even more divided over what they think of the mainstream press. Because if you look at American political and cultural life post Roe v. Wade, religious issues have become the most important and divisive issues in American politics as well as in American religion and culture. So thus, to some degree, if we now have different parts of the mainstream press, especially elite newspapers, now articulating the viewpoint of the theological left, this should create even less trust of the press in America, and even though that would be hard to do.
Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He's founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time talking about what's being called reformational Catholicism. What is Protestantism? Is it time for Protestantism to come to an end? This attitude that whatever the Roman Catholic Church has been or is, we are not, which is arguably kind of the popular view of Protestantism. Has that particular viewpoint outlived its usefulness, if it ever was useful? When we come back, Peter Lighthart will join us. We'll talk about the end of Protestantism.
In Hosea 4, we read, "My people are destroyed by lack of knowledge." At the CLCC, we educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. The Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Christians would if they learned what we believe, teach, and confess. Visit our website at theclcc.org. See what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us. And encourage your pastors to hold an event in your area. For more information, go to theclcc.org.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, etc. 300. Trinity Lutheran, Bridgeton, Missouri; Calvary Lutheran, Elgin, Illinois; Advent Lutheran, Zionsville, Indiana; Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Worth, Texas; Holy Cross Lutheran, Albany, Oregon; St. John's Lutheran, Evanston, Indiana; Mount Calvary Lutheran, San Antonio, Texas; Good Shepherd Lutheran, Boise, Idaho; Village Lutheran, Ladue, Missouri; Emmanuel Lutheran, Osceola, Iowa; St. Paul Lutheran, Clarinda, Iowa; Trinity Lutheran, Lebanon, Missouri; Mount Calvary Lutheran, Excelsior Springs, Missouri; the Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Cupertino, California; Christ Our Savior Lutheran, Freeburg, Illinois; and Peace Lutheran, Neenah, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Support, the Issues Etc. 300.
Pastor Todd, I downloaded your Issues Etc. app for my Android phone, and I listen to it while I'm on the treadmill.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live or on demand with the new Issues Etc. Android or iPhone app. You can download these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. Download an app today.
My new Adam really enjoys the app while I'm on the treadmill.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Where else you might deceive us.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.